Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Miller is the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Program, and he's also the author of Choices in Breast Cancer Treatment. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, as we reach the end of Lung Cancer Awareness Month, Ed and Ken welcome the directors of the Yale Cancer Center Thoracic Oncology Program, Drs. Frank Detterbeck and Lynn Tanui. Dr. Detterbeck is a professor of thoracic surgery at Yale, and Dr. Tanui is a professor of pulmonary medicine.
Unfortunately, it is a common cancer, and it's actually the most common cause of death from cancer. And if you add up the number of cancer deaths from lung cancer, it actually exceeds the combination of breast, prostate, colorectal, and pancreatic cancers all combined. More women will actually die of lung cancer than ovarian cancer and breast cancer. And more non-smoking women will die of lung cancer than ovarian cancer. So it's a very common cancer, unfortunately. It claims a lot of lives.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that. I mean, on one hand, it's not as common as breast cancer. And on the other hand, there's more people, more women dying of it. So, I mean, how do you explain that?
Well, we don't have a good way of early detection. And I think that's one of the important things that lung cancer research needs to focus on, a way to screen, which we really don't have right now. And I think there is relatively poor awareness of the fact that lung cancer is so common. And breast and ovarian cancer have gotten a lot more attention over the last several decades, and lung cancer relatively little, although that's changing.
Frank, when we think of lung cancer, what are the typical risk factors that one should be aware of?
Well, certainly the thing that comes to everyone's mind is smoking, and there's no question that smoking is the major risk factor. But really, many people stop thinking after smoking, and there clearly are other risk factors. We certainly see lung cancer in non-smokers. In fact, over half of the people that we diagnose with lung cancer now are people that quit smoking years and years ago. I'm not talking about quit smoking 2 weeks ago, but they quit smoking 20, 30 years ago. And in fact, if you look at lung cancer in non-smokers, it's equal to, say, people with lymphoma. It's not a minor, group of people. So what are other factors? Well, family history is clearly one. If you have a first-degree relative with lung cancer corrected for any secondhand smoke exposure or whatever, you clearly do. So there clearly is some genetic factor. There are occupational exposures. Asbestos is one of the major ones. If you have evidence of obstructive airways disease, so emphysema, that is an independent risk factor, independent from whatever effect smoking may have had, as well.
And I think, one thing that is, I think, commonly misunderstood, I know I hear this a lot from patients, is that, doc, I've quit smoking 15, 20 years ago. So does the risk of developing lung cancer go to completely zero, or is there still a residual risk for developing lung cancer?
There clearly is still a residual risk. It doesn't go to zero. Even the early studies, I think, were kind of misinterpreted as suggesting that the risk goes down to zero. Certainly, the risk diminishes relative to continued smoking, but it never goes down to that of a non-smoker. And basically, whatever risk you've built up during your years of smoking, you kind of maintain that through your life. You don't build it up any higher, but you don't really lose whatever you've built up.
I just want to add something to what Dr. Detterbeck said, and that is that the risk diminishes when you stop smoking. And that is true no matter how old you are. Mm-hmm. So even people who stop smoking when they're 50 and 60 and 70 have a decrease in their lung cancer risk, as well as, importantly, a decrease in their cardiovascular and cerebrovascular risk. So the chances of having a heart attack or a stroke go down really quickly, and the chance of having lung cancer goes down steadily over time. And while it never reaches the level of a never smoker, it gets pretty low.
And what about this issue of secondhand smoke? We've heard a lot about that issue recently, and I'm just curious what each of you think about secondhand smoke and the risk for developing lung cancer.
Well, it clearly is a risk factor. There's no question about it, but I think it's been overblown. For example, the risk with a first-degree relative is about 400% higher than that of a, non-smoker without a first-degree relative. The risk with secondhand smoke is about 40% higher. So we're talking 10 times higher family history, and yet we talk about secondhand smoke 10 times more than we talk about family history. So,
well, along those lines, so let's say someone is at higher risk, and I'll talk about a couple populations. One are people that smoke. Second are people that were smokers. Third are people with a family history or some combinations thereof. What constitutes good screening? Is there any screening?
There is no recommendation to screen the population at large. I think for people who recognize that they have risk, because they have a lot of factors like they smoked, they have emphysema, they have a family history, they may have had occupational exposure, that's different than population. That's an individual decision. And so if an individual person feels they have excessive risk because of those factors, that's something they should speak about with their physicians. And then a very conscious decision made whether or not to pursue usually an imaging study like a chest X-ray or maybe even a CT scan. But those are conversations that should happen between an individual and their own physician.
There's been also a lot written recently, and we hear in the news and the reports about the beneficial effects of CAT scan, as you just mentioned, Lynn. And I'm just curious where you folks weigh in on the role of CAT scan in early detection screening of lung cancer.
Well, certainly CT has been studied a lot. There have been really a lot of efforts towards having a screening test for lung cancer, but we're not there. And, one of the things we've realized with CT scans is that we're picking up a different spectrum of disease. So we pick up things that are very slow-growing, very indolent tumors that we didn't really pick up as well. And I think we're still struggling to understand what do we do about those tumors. And we don't necessarily want to approach those with the same approach as we have the more aggressive lung cancer. So, screening, it changes the spectrum of disease. You have to understand that as well. And without really understanding it better, I don't think we can define where that fits at this point.
So, in your thoracic oncology program, what do you recommend in terms of, say, an individual like Ken said that has a high risk for developing lung cancer?
I think those individuals, again, have to speak with their physicians who know their history and can appreciate all the nuances of their risks. And then, again, an individual decision made as to whether to pursue any sort of imaging study to look in a more directed fashion. As a population, though, on a population level, there is no evidence right now that there should be screening done on a general level the way mammogram is done for breast cancer, PSA for prostate, and so forth.
So I think one of the issues with screening is that you really need to look at the risk. And I think that underscores what Lynn was saying. I think the patient should discuss it with their physician and have some, thoughtful input towards that. Screening just a broad population, people over 50 that, smoke for some period of their life, we're not there to recommend anything on that. But if you can increase the pool of people that are at higher risk, then that's a different group of people to look at. That's a different situation. And so I think that's a very important piece of it.
I want to ask you, we get a number of emails from people saying, what's the very best way to find out, if I have breast cancer or prostate cancer? So let me pose a clinical question. If a patient sat in front of you and said, doctor, listen, I want to be as vigilant as possible. I've been a smoker. I wish I hadn't been. What's the gold standard, Lynn, in terms of, you know, what would you tell that patient if he or she was sitting in front of you?
Again, there isn't a gold standard. That's the problem. We certainly appreciate that mammography and PSA, even colonoscopy, will pick up lots of findings that are abnormal but not cancer, and we can deal with them. Those are reasonably easy places, for instance, to do a biopsy. The problem with CT scanning, which was, supposed to help us with this, is that it is too sensitive. And what I mean by that is that when you do a CT scan, particularly in a population of people who smoked, even 10 pack years, it's very, very likely you'll find something. In fact, these studies, of which there have now been a number, find abnormalities in one scan, just the first scan, in between 12 to over 50% of the people being screened. And of those many, many, many abnormalities now, maybe 1 to 2% of them are cancers. And so you have to deal with the other 98 to 99% of them, which aren't cancers. But to know that confidently often requires many imaging studies over time, which requires waiting and being able to live with that, or invasive things like biopsies or even surgeries. And that's what Dr. Detterbeck was talking about, risk, that these are procedures that can carry risk and, complications. So that at the present time, the benefit of doing things like CT scanning is outweighed probably by the risk of those procedures and our increasing knowledge that some of these cancers we pick up this way are probably never going to hurt people. Mm. The way that little prostate cancers that we pick up by low PSA, high PSA, often won't hurt somebody, but we do invasive procedures to figure that out. And so weighing all those things right now, it is probably more harmful to do the screening with CT studies on a population basis than not to do them.
Frank, I'm just curious, for prostate cancer, obviously we have PSA, and now there's some blood tests emerging to detect ovarian cancer at earlier stages, and I'm just curious, where are we in terms of trying to develop simple blood tests that might be able to, again, identify high-risk populations who would have lung cancer?
Well, there's also been work done in that regard. There's actually a paper that was just published just a few weeks ago from Yale, Joanne Wiethaus and Frank Slack, and they looked at microRNAs, which are relatively new. It's something that hadn't been recognized for a long time. And the thing about microRNAs is that they can influence an abnormality in the microRNA can influence a lot of different genes. And so it potentially has a lot more effect. They previously were not very well understood. What this study showed is that the incidence of a genetic mutation in a particular microRNA was much higher in the people who develop lung cancer than in a baseline population. So in other words, this potentially is a way of trying to figure out who's at higher risk. And as we already talked about before, if we can figure out who's at higher risk, we're a whole lot further along in perhaps saying, well, now this is an appropriate population to do CT screening in.
I want to change the topic a little bit for, in terms of symptoms. And when patients, you see unfortunately, a lot of new patients with lung cancer. What symptoms do they report?
I think individuals should really seek medical attention for things like persistent cough. Definitely if you're coughing up blood, if you have chest pain that doesn't resolve, fevers that don't go away. Symptoms that persist and are unusual always should have medical attention.
I want to underscore that a little bit. We probably can detect lung cancers earlier if people pay more attention to subtle symptoms. That's another area of research that we want to pursue. Many people quit smoking, for reasons that I think they're not entirely clear about. And then within a year, they're diagnosed with a lung cancer. And probably if we study this a little bit more, we realize that there are reasons why they quit smoking. And if we can pick up on that and be more aware of it, I think that we stand a chance to get an edge on those people that actually have a lung cancer already there.
Well, we're going to take a break for a minute, we'll be back after a medical minute to hear more about lung cancer with Dr. Lynn Tanui and Dr. Frank Detter back from the Yale Cancer Center.
Here in Connecticut, the American Cancer Society estimates that almost 1,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer every month. The good news is that when you detect it early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. That means that if you're over the age of 50, you should have regular colonoscopies to screen for this disease. In the case of patients that develop colorectal cancer, there are more options than ever before, thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our guests, Dr. Frank Detterbach and Dr. Lynn Tanui from the Yale Cancer Center. And we're talking about lung cancer. All right, so we're talking a little bit about these, perhaps these subtle symptoms that people may have that perhaps will give us some clues. When a patient has those types of symptoms, I mean, how would you evaluate it, and what happens when, and how do you make the diagnosis for that matter?
Well, I think, first of all, I would encourage people, if they have some subtle symptoms, probably a good idea to actually talk with their physician about that and not to blow it off for a long period of time.
And who should they see? Should they see their, family doctor, the internist, or should they go and see a pulmonary specialist such as Dr. Tanui?
I think their family doctor, their internist, is always the best bet because that person usually knows the patient. And then if that physician feels that a referral should be made to a specialist, they can choose which appropriate specialist to make that referral to. I would strongly encourage everybody to keep their family doctor in the loop. You want somebody who will steer your little boat, even if there are many oars rowing.
Mm-hmm. And then just following up on what Dr. Miller was saying, so then what kind of tests would be done once an individual goes to see their general family doctor?
Well, certainly one of the straightforward tests is a chest X-ray. And while there is pretty good data from a number of studies we've done in the past that a screening chest X-ray just on a broad population isn't really worthwhile, I think that's a very different situation from someone who comes in with some subtle symptoms and it's not so clear. I think that's a very different situation, and one shouldn't say, well, chest X-ray has proven not to be useful in that situation. I think we've gone a little bit wrong in that regard. We often see people who had some symptoms, they were seen, and yet it took 6 months before they ever got a chest X-ray.
All right. After a patient is is diagnosed, I mean, does everybody have surgery of some kind?
Well, no. I think you need a biopsy of some sort, but surgery as a treatment for lung cancer certainly is it's a major treatment for lung cancer. But it used to be said, well, if you can't have surgery, there's really nothing that can be done, and that's certainly not true. We have excellent radiation. We have excellent chemotherapy drugs. In fact, I have backed off, and I think many in the surgical community have backed off in a number of situations from doing surgery because we get such good results with other treatments, so that surgery isn't necessarily the only treatment that works. The other thing, though, I think, is that we've learned that a combination of treatments is in many situations more effective than just one treatment alone.
Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about, say, for instance, a patient is diagnosed with lung cancer, seen by your thoracic oncology group at Yale. What goes into deciding what kind of treatment should be then initiated for an individual patient?
The group, which consists of thoracic surgeons like Dr. Dedebick, pulmonologists like myself, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, our social worker, pathology, diagnostic imaging, nuclear medicine, and so forth. Our job at that initial evaluation of a new patient is to decide if they have a lung cancer, if a biopsy needs to be done, and what the stage is. And lung cancer, like all solid organ cancers, is classified as different stages. And for lung cancer, that's 1 through 4. And the initial assessment of what the best treatment is will be based on the stage. So the very important focus of the group, of our tumor board, is to decide what the likely stage is, because that guides the initial assessment about treatment.
Let me add to that in a general way. So I think that many diseases have become more complex, and there's a greater knowledge base, and there really isn't any one person that knows everything about that disease. Everybody has sort of a little different chunk of it and a little different view, and the key thing, I think, is to get that collective brain power working and collective judgment. And so our policy is that all major decisions about patients, whether it's how they should be evaluated, how they should be treated, are really made by the whole team. That doesn't mean that that patient needs to see a whole bunch of different people, but it gets discussed so that the collective wisdom and judgment of that whole team can be brought to bear on making that decision.
Frank, I want to ask you about what is minimally invasive surgery for lung cancer? What does that mean?
Well, things have changed dramatically. It used to be an operation for lung cancer was a big incision, often removal of a rib, and it was very painful, and it was a big ordeal. And now the majority of resections that we do for lung cancer, for anything really, are done with a video camera, with about a quarter inch incision for the video camera, and some other incisions that are about a half to three quarters of an inch long. So it's much less invasive. It's much less painful. Typically, people are in the hospital about 2.5 to 3 days. Usually within a week or two, people are getting around quite well. It's a very different experience because we've modified the incision and how invasive the operation is.
Now, as we were talking about earlier, many patients at risk for developing lung cancer have underlying lung disease. So is there a need, requirement to have to try to assess their kind of underlying lung function status before they can be taken for surgery?
Absolutely. Any patient who's going to be having thoracic surgery, whether it's in the old style with a big incision, which is less common, or with a videoscopic approach, should have their lung function assessed. Particularly with the minimally invasive approach, the recovery is easier, but that patient will have gone through a big surgery nonetheless. So it's important to assess their pulmonary function to see if there's something that can be done preoperatively to maximize that function, or to anticipate postoperatively if there might be any needs.
I think, though, that we also have to be careful about what we consider to be too high risk. There are a lot of nuances about that, and, you know, certainly some of the data that we have really applies to the old style operation, and I think it's pretty clear that with minimally invasive techniques and newer things that mortality is lower. I think that there's also reason to select some people that have really poor lung function, because in fact their lung function is going to be better. But you have to be careful about choosing those patients, but it's not a simple answer.
And once surgery is done, is there any role for any follow-up therapy such as radiation therapy or chemotherapy?
In many situations, there is. I mentioned earlier that we do a lot more combination treatments. Not in all situations. In some situations, we do so well with surgery alone that there's really no reason to add anything. But in many situations, we know that we do fairly well with surgery, but we clearly do somewhat better by adding some additional treatment. Most often, it's really additional chemotherapy, to a lesser extent, radiation.
Hmm. I want to ask about, you know, I know there's a lot of exciting work going on throughout the country at NEL also. What are some of the trials you're working on and some of the projects that you're excited about?
We have clinical trials open for nearly every stage of lung cancer. And it's very important that patients have access to new drugs, new therapies, because they take advantage of all the scientific discoveries that have been made over the past few years. And for lung cancer, there have been some incredibly exciting advances that have really changed the way that we approach patients. 5 years ago, we probably wouldn't have given chemotherapy in addition to surgery for some patients with early stage lung cancer, but it's clear now that we can get improved survival, decreased death over time when we use these multiple approaches to patients even with early stage disease. We're really interested in the kind of research that Dr. Detterbeck discussed earlier. How can we define patients who are at higher risk? Can we predict whether patients who have had cancers are going to go on to relapse? And we have been collaborating with colleagues at Yale, for instance, in the pathology division, to try to identify biochemical markers that we can see in biopsy specimens and perhaps even in blood to identify populations that might benefit from other therapy, novel therapies, and so forth.
I'll just add a little something about clinical trials. You know, clinical trials sometimes represent a, you know, very new drug, for example, that, you know, really we don't have a lot of experience with. But that isn't really the only situation. There are many clinical trials that use drugs that have been used quite a bit, but they're used in a slightly different combination. And what it really represents is it represents a very carefully thought out, organized way of providing treatment that some of the, you know, best minds in the country have gotten together and discussed and think that this is probably a better way to do things. So it's very well thought out, it's very well organized, and I think that is a reason why, in general, people do better if they are treated on a clinical trial than if I get actually the same treatment interventions but done off trial. It's just not as organized, and it tends not to give as good results.
Frank, we're hearing a lot about the role of targeted therapies, either alone or in combination with chemotherapy, to treat patients with lung cancer, kind of following up on what you just said. And maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what's going on in terms of trying to combine those new targeted molecules with traditional chemotherapy.
Well, clearly, it's been an exciting time in lung cancer, and targeted therapy is one of the reasons for that excitement. When we understand a particular tumor and why this tumor is growing, and we can flip that switch off, we have really dramatic results. Unfortunately, we don't understand quite as well how to pick those patients, and we only know that switch exists for a relatively small number at this point. But we've come a long ways to understanding that better, and there's a lot of research going on in this area.
You know, just projecting into the future, but I mean, if you had a crystal ball, which none of us have, but, you know, where do you think the big breakthroughs will be in terms of treating lung cancer?
I think there will be many. We need to understand better how to define populations at risk, and we need to really focus on understanding the biology of these tumors so that we can develop targeted therapy, broader treatment approaches for patients who do develop cancers.
I want to add how important it is to be treated and seen in an organized way and appropriately staged. There's a recent study that suggests that by just doing a better job of evaluating patients, we will decrease increase the survival for patients with lung cancer about 5 times as much as for things that we call breakthrough new treatments.
Great. Well, I think that's a terrific message to end the show on. You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our guest experts, Drs. Frank Detterbeck and Lynn Tanui, for joining us this evening. And we look forward, Lynn and Frank, to having you back on a future show and to hear more about what's going on with the thoracic oncology program. Until next week, I'm Dr. Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions for the doctors or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. Next week, Drs. John Kohlberg and Richard Peschel join Ed and Ken to talk about prostate cancer. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.